All right, you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is Roots and Culture, making the world unsafe for a plutocracy. I'm Max, and we got LL here in the studio as well.
And on the phone, we have with us John Stauber.
John Stauber is on this evening to discuss his book, co-authored with Sheldon Rampton, entitled Trust Us, We're the Experts, How Industry Manipulates Science and Gambles with Your Future. Stauber and Rampton are also the authors of Toxic Sludge is Good for You and Mad Cow USA. And so we'd just like to welcome you on the air, John.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be on your program.
All right. Well, we appreciate you taking the time tonight to be with us on the air. And you have this great new book out called Trust Us. Trust Us, We're the Experts, How Industry Manipulates Science and Gambles with Your Future. Can you please tell us a little bit about the book?
Sure. Maybe I should describe a little bit what our beat is. Sheldon Rampton and I work for a nonprofit called the Center for Media and Democracy, and we've been doing that since we started it back in 1993. And we write about something that, you know, isn't supposed to exist in democratic countries, and that's organized manipulative propaganda. But of course, it's in democratic countries, really, that we have the most sophisticated propaganda. And in our first book, Toxic Sludge is Good for You, Lies, Damn Lies in the Public Relations Industry, we looked at this multi-billion dollar industry that's so pervasive, that's so hidden, that isn't reported on by the mainstream media, because so much of what the media passes on as news is actually the result of corporate PR campaigns.
Yeah.
In this book, Trust Us, We're Experts, How Industry Manipulates Science and Gambles with Your Future, we specifically look at health and safety issues and two types of experts. The propaganda experts who work for public relations companies and manage issues dealing with environmental health and safety and toxins and genetically engineered food, global climate change, and then the so-called independent experts in the media and the scientific experts, the authorities, that they push forward to deliver their message. Because if the coal industry suddenly announces that global warming is good for you, it's ludicrous. It's just ridiculous. It's laughable.
Yeah.
But if a nonprofit organization called the Greening Earth Society sponsors legitimate scientists who are willing to make that argument that, in fact, global warming is really great for us, is going to be more photosynthesis, more green stuff, and isn't that the epitome of the environment? We're going to be growing pineapples in Canada. Gee, that sounds like maybe there's something to it. You know, maybe all this concern over global climate change is just environmental fear-mongering. So we, in this issue, tackle a broad range of tactics and strategies used by the PR industry to put industry's message in the mouths of experts who we're supposed to trust.
Uh-huh. And can you tell us a little, you take us through the birth of this third-party technique and the birth of spin through the story of the American Tobacco Company back in 1929 and along with women's voting rights. I was wondering if you could just take us through that a little bit as well.
Sure, I'd be happy to. In our first book, Toxic Sludge is Good for You, Sheldon and I had all sorts of contemporary horror stories of PR companies spying on activists involved with genetically engineered food issues, for instance, and working with Monsanto and the U.S. government to falsely assure us that genetically engineered foods are safe. But we didn't really know much about where this propaganda industry came from. Mm-hmm. And so for Toxic Sludge is Good for You, we sat down with Bob McChesney, who's an incredible author and media critic. One of his books is Rich Media, Poor Democracy. He and John Nichols also have written a smaller book titled It's the Media, Stupid. And McChesney sort of clued us in on how the public relations industry developed. And it developed out of a massive wartime campaign to sell involvement and fighting and dying in World War I to the American people. Back around the time of World War I, many Americans or their parents or grandparents had immigrated specifically to avoid Europe's wars. And now here was the Wilson administration elected as a peace administration suddenly saying, well, we're going to have to go fight this war in Europe. It was extremely unpopular. And the Wilson administration put together what was at the time the largest war propaganda campaign ever. And people like Eddie Bernays, who's today known as the father of the PR industry, and Ivy Lee, the inventor of the press release, and others came out of that campaign. And then after doing such a good job of turning around American opinion on the war, World War I, they went to work for industry. And they specifically had great success helping the tobacco industry break this taboo that existed at the time against women smoking. And Bernays himself was just an absolutely fascinating character because he was a double nephew of Sigmund Freud, the father of psychoanalysis, Freudian analysis. And Bernays literally learned the various techniques for subliminal manipulation that he developed for the PR industry at the knee of his Uncle Sigmund.
Now, thinking about the connections that were made by Edward Bernays back in the day, do you see any of the possible connections between some of this early work and the creation of confluence of interest between the U.S. efforts on this so-called war on terrorism and then also on women's rights in Afghanistan? And what are some of your thoughts on this?
Well, you know, that's the amazing thing about propaganda in countries like the United States, that when you really sort of pull back the curtain, like we do in Trust Us, We're Experts, and Toxic Sludge is Good for You, and in our quarterly PR watch, what you see are strategies and tactics that always work if there isn't an aware and educated public and an investigative media blowing the whistle on these tactics. They're very basic appeals to emotionalism and to symbolism. And in the situation of the post-September 11th world, it's, of course, very easy for the Bush administration to get just about anything at once because this attack that took place, you know, really fired up a level of nationalism and a level of fear that I don't think has ever existed in the United States in my lifetime. I was born post-World War II. And once a people are willing to follow a government into war, the government has a tremendous amount of power to take that carte blanche just about anywhere it wants to. And what's really, I think, most upsetting about the current situation is that the media that should be investigating and criticizing and examining U.S. foreign policy, especially the television media, the cable TV shows like the CNN programs and MSNBC and, of course, especially Fox News, are really cheerleaders for the administration and for war. It's very frightening because, you know, these TV networks are most concerned about ratings, they're most concerned about viewers, and now they have a situation that's absolutely ideal, and they're playing it for all it's worth. And there's a tremendous amount of just blind warmongering that's taking place. governmental tactics and strategies that are used by governments to conduct war and to manipulate the public are as old as the work of Eddie Bernays. For instance, there's a public relations firm out of Virginia called Rendon, and the Pentagon, shortly after September 11th, hired this firm. They've done a lot of work for the CIA in the past. And, of course, this is subject to much national security censorship, but we do know that one thing that the Rendon firm is doing is they're monitoring the media coverage outside the United States of the U.S. Attacks on Afghanistan. And that sounds very passive, but actually that is part of an effort to analyze the content of the media in the foreign press and then to influence it and to ascertain what opinion leaders in Muslim countries have, and then to develop PR and advertising campaigns to affect those opinions. Of course, yeah. The irony is that they're absolutely botching it horribly, because rather than do the intelligent and reasonable thing and examine U.S. foreign policy and figure out why the image of the United States is at such a low level in the Islamic world, there's this hubris that they can simply launch an advertising campaign in the Muslim world, use somebody like Muhammad Ali, which they're doing, sit down with Hollywood executives and have Hollywood develop pro-American messages and themes for movies, which they're doing, and that this sort of painting over and really crass manipulation is going to change deep-seated and fundamental attitudes that are based on the public perception of the U.S. as being anti-Muslim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting because I think what is the main Muslim source of news, the Al-Jahari's media, and like how different administration people have scheduled interview times with them.
Right. Well, you know, and it's going to hopefully in the years ahead and the decades ahead, you know, there'll be more light shown on what's transpired in Central Asia and in the Arab countries vis-a-vis U.S. policies and actions over the last 6 months. I guess the terrorist attack in New York was exactly 5 months ago today. But one of the real immediate concerns, of course, of the administration was Al Jazeera Television out of Yemen, broadcasting information, including interviews with Osama bin Laden, that the United States didn't want to see. And clearly there was pressure applied on Al Jazeera through the Yemeni's government, which is the benefactor of the TV station, the TV network. In fact, I don't know if you remember this, but I believe it was when Kabul fell, the Al Jazeera office in Kabul was bombed by the United States.
Wow.
And they said it was, you know, a
collateral damage, perhaps.
Bin Laden office, an Al-Qaeda office, but the Al Jazeera people said, no, absolutely, it was sending a message. Yeah, it's a very interesting media environment today. You know, I remember even a decade ago during the Gulf War when the U.S. ally at the time, Saddam Hussein, apparently got the wrong message from the Bush administration and took over the Kuwaiti oil fields and occupied Kuwait. There, back then, was no internet. There were no websites. There was no ability to easily transmit analysis and information about that war to millions of people around the world. This current situation is unfolding with the internet, and one thing that I think is very encouraging is that even though the medium that most Americans use to receive their news and information, television, is a little more than a gung-ho cheerleading operation for whatever the Bush administration wants to do, you can go to sites like alternet.org or commondreams.org or our site, prwatch.org, and from there branch off and receive all sorts of information, well-documented and good analysis. So it's, you know, it's a little different media environment. There isn't quite the total control of information that took place even 10 years ago with the Gulf War.
Yeah. We want to remind our listeners, you're listening to John Stauber. He's with us tonight on Roots and Culture by telephone. He is just finished writing a book. It's out now, and he co-authored it with Sheldon Rampton. It's called Trust Us, We're Experts, How Industry Manipulates Science and Gambles with Your Future. Stauber and Rampton also were authors of Toxic Sludge is Good for You and Mad Cow USA. John Stauber is the founder and director of the nonprofit Center for Media and Democracy in Madison, Wisconsin.
So as we're talking about the current war on terrorism and some of the things going on, I mean, I hate to ask, I don't mean to ask an obvious nor rhetorical question, but as you just mentioned before, some of the rather obvious things, such as the U.S. government, the administration looking at perhaps some of the structural or root causes behind why there's such an anti-U.S. sentiment abroad in Islamic nations. I'm just thinking about the Bush administration's tactics to outspin and fight propaganda, and that with Al Jazeera and that with Al Qaeda, and thinking about this somewhat of a quasi-arms race, a propaganda race, and how does truth play out? You mentioned a few of those alternative websites such as PR Watch. How does truth get communicated to the public about what's really going on?
Well, yeah, that's not a rhetorical question at all. It really comes down to the basic problem. And that problem is that we live in this almost false environment created by commercial media, funded by corporate advertising. I was lucky enough to be able to get away to Mexico last week, and I came back over the weekend, and I spent the week with no television, you know, no ads in English, and then suddenly arriving back in the U.S., one of the first things I see in a rental car agency is CNN 24-hour news, you know, the big color screen propped where everyone who's trying to rent a car has to watch this. And, of course, in the week that I was gone, they came up with this new image. And it just, because I'd been away and I hadn't seen it and it hit me for the first time, it really blew me away. It was the axis of evil. And it was so upsetting. And, you know, it's a situation where the president, you know, with all his opinion polling and message development, is able to create a phrase, the axis of evil, and identify, you know, three countries that he considers this axis of evil, and through the media create it. And the media pick up on this. It's worse than Orwellian, because Orwell wrote 1984 half a century ago, even before television, and he really couldn't imagine the degree of propaganda that we truly live with. It's much more sophisticated and pervasive than anything either Huxley or Orwell could have come up with. So how do we get beyond this political exploitation of events that's taken place literally since September 12th by corporations and by right-wing politicians? And how do we not allow ourselves to be just emotional pawns in this game of allowing the administration to play out all its political and foreign policy fantasies? That's really what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think what it comes down to, again, as all things do, is community education and organizing and mobilization. There's also, I think, a situation here that is unique, at least again in my lifetime, which is that the terrorist threat posed by Islamic extremists is, in my opinion, absolutely real. And there is a need for international police and military action to stop extremely dedicated, well-trained, and of course much of the training was by the US CIA decades ago with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, which is, you know, the roots of a lot of the current problem with Al-Qaeda. So, you know, the Bush administration essentially has this the green light to do what they want. And what I'm hoping is that European countries and other nations that have more sense and, frankly, much more commitment to freedom, democracy, and human rights than the Bush administration will help to put the brakes on a runaway military situation. You know, a real interesting situation in the United States also is that these events are unfolding in an environment where there really is no opposition. You know, we essentially have two political parties in this country, but they're really two wings of the same political party. You know, one is very conservative, corporate-funded. That's the Democratic Party. And the other is far-right, corporate-funded, and that's the Republican Party. And what strikes me is, you know, we don't see the champions arise in Congress or in the Senate or at the state level to really speak out strongly and mobilize a very unique peace and justice movement in this country that can learn from the 11th, that can change U.S. foreign policy, that can make U.S. foreign policy more just, while also cooperating internationally to secure the peace so that the Al-Qaeda network doesn't succeed in carrying out more terrorism. But, of course, we've seen terrorism in other countries, and there will be more terrorism, and, you know, it's there's very little in reality that any government can do to stop the dedicated terrorist efforts of a handful of people working together in a cell might perpetrate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, bombing Afghanistan at this point, or carrying the war to Iraq at this point, seems to me that it's just going to be tremendously counterproductive.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting when I was reading your book. It was at post September 11th. This the book for everyone out there. Trust Us, We're Experts. When I was reading through that, you had mentioned during the Great Depression of 1929 that spin doctors and advertisers and businesses offered slogans such as "Be patriotic and spend money," "Spend 10 cents more each day and help drive the hard time away." I don't know if that was a jingle or something. It sounds a little bit melodic.
Eddie Bernays helped come up with that. Yeah, it's, you know, I'll tell you, one of the strange things about writing a book is going back and rereading it. And it's funny because information in the book can take on a very new meaning. And I just reread that section you're talking about. It.
Mm-hmm.
That was in 1929, one of the greatest public relations stunts of all time. You know, the public relations industry that grew out of World War I was exposed and hated and disliked in the 1920s. Eddie Bernays was a fascinating character because he called what he did by its proper name. He called it propaganda. And he really believed that democracy was a system of government that required management by a small elite because people are too stupid and too emotional and too anarchistic to cooperate in ways that Bernays, a liberal intellectual, thought is appropriate. And his ideas really stunned and shocked many people, especially people in the media in the 1920s, and there was a backlash against public relations. But public relations went on anyway, and in 1929, Bernays had the opportunity to do something that he thought would really show the good of public relations, and that was the 50th anniversary of Thomas Alva Edison's invention of the light bulb. And this became the most phenomenal event involving Henry Ford and Edison and all the media, and it steamrolled sort of like the Olympics, you know, without the advertising.
Right.
Bernays was coordinating it, but it just took on a life of its own. And the irony was, it was about 4 days before Black Thursday, the huge stock market crash that heralded the Depression. And, you know, these people like Bernays, who were so involved in manipulating events, thinking that they were really in control, had no idea for quite a while that this was it. You know, the happy days were over, and a bleak depression was emerging. And so Bernays went to work for Calvin Coolidge, and they wouldn't deal with the problems of capitalism in a systemic way, so they came up with these slogans that really sound so much like these sickening ads you see on television with President Bush telling the nation to go out there and travel and spend money and eat at restaurants and fly in airplanes to revive the economy.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than dealing with the ills of a system and with injustices, and with the problems of the capitalist system, just trying to gloss it over with messages like spend money, be happy.
Right. And then and now with the current Bush administration, post-September 11th, with the economy faltering and certain calls for patriotic acts, how do you see, I mean, obviously there are a number of connections to be made there.
Yeah, I think... you know, just from a personal standpoint, you know, I think what happened on September 11th was really a massive signaled a massive generational shift.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you look back to even a year and a half ago, the dot-com craze, the stock market going wild, low unemployment. Not a dark cloud on the horizon. It's a completely different day now, not only because of the terrorist attacks on September 11th and the ensuing military action and military buildup and the change of administrations, but also I think this economic collapse. And I think this is just, you know, my opinion, but I think we're really going to see very hard times in the years and decades ahead, as problems that have been glossed over and ignored and covered up by public relations manipulations, as these sort of chickens come home to roost, economic problems, environmental problems, all in an environment in which corporations are politically more powerful than ever, and civil government is weakened. And what's really troubling about the current situation is that the Bush administration is attacking civil liberties. They're refusing to provide information that the public and Congress has a right to. They're spending, you know, unbelievable amounts on a military buildup. They're sticking, with Democratic support, by the way, to a tax giveaway that benefits the wealthy and is built into the years ahead, despite the fact that that's now completely irrational, because that huge tax giveaway, in my opinion, didn't make sense when we were riding the crest of this economic boom. But now that we're fallen into the trough of a recession, it's insane policy. And yet there just aren't people speaking up in the mainstream, for the most part, really calling this. So I think that there's a tremendous challenge here and an opportunity, and especially to a younger generation to call things as they see them, because the problems that need addressing really require fundamental change, and I think for the most part come down to the problems of the corporate economic system and corporate globalization.
John Stauber is with us this evening talking about a book that he co-authored with Sheldon Rampton called Trust Us, We're the Experts, How Industry Manipulates Science and Gambles with Your Future. Stauber and Rampton are also authors of Toxic Sludge is Good for You and Mad Cow USA. John Stauber is founder and director of the Nonprofit Center for Media and Democracy in beloved Madison, Wisconsin.
Thanks again for being with us this evening. John, are you there?
I am.
Okay. I know a lot of the media now has been following the surrounding collapse of Enron, and Max and I are just curious if you've been following some of that, and if so, how might some of the behind-the-scenes, quote, damage control or issue management or, quote, disaster management, maybe even more crisis management, relate to the issues you discuss in your book regarding what we have dubbed the invisible public relations industry?
Right. Well, and it is. The public relations industry and propaganda is invisible. If it's visible, if you can see it happening, it doesn't work. You know, and all of us think we're just too intelligent, too cynical, too well-educated to be fooled, and that certainly the free press in this country would reveal any manipulative hidden campaigns. But as we document in our books and writings, no, that's not the case. In the United States, we're the most propagandized people in history, and the propaganda business here really is a business, a huge multi-billion-dollar industry, and probably 40% or more of everything you see, hear, and read in the media as news and information is actually the result of that industry. And it's, you know, it's a media which is fueled by corporate advertising dollars and is very careful not to bite the hand that feeds it. And it's also a media that is happy to take information provided by PR firms that are subsidiaries of the advertising companies and put that out as news. So, you know, let the scales fall from our eyes. We really do live in a tremendously sophisticated propaganda environment, a real virtual reality every time we listen to the commercial media and ads. And it's the messages that we don't see that are the most dangerous ones, and that's what we write about in all our work, but especially in Trust Us, We're Experts, the hidden messages in the experts on the news shows.
Yeah. And, you know, given this lucrative media spin-industrial complex...
That's a good term.
...you describe in Trust Us, We're Experts, and how capital can translate to the production of a desired effect on the U.S. citizenry, you know, I'm reminded of how much Super Bowl ads cost and just how lucrative those spots can be. Readers of this book and others, how can they sort of activate ourselves to become greater civic participants, demand greater participatory democracy, and combat the scenario of, you know, we're a docile and passive receiver or consumer?
Well, you know, that's the key right there. How do we take our democracy back? And I think it begins with us personally reclaiming our lives and defining our lives in terms that are important to us. You asked about Enron and how that whole situation is being managed. And if, you know, what does that mean for us as individuals? I think the Enron collapse will actually be remembered as much as the terrorist attacks on September 11th. I think these two events are really going to be seen as you know, heralding this this new and dangerous era of crises coming home to roost. What's interesting about Enron is that the politicians have a vested interest in not looking at this too closely, because even though the Bush administration was tremendously involved with helping Enron, so was the Clinton administration.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And, you know, it's funny to watch the spin that some of the right-wing think tanks are putting on Enron to try to change and deflect the image that this is a Bush Republican scandal. The Capital Research Associates, which is funded by industry and which researches public interest and activist groups and their funding, has pointed out recently that Enron gave large amounts of money, hundreds of thousands of dollars, to big mainstream environmental groups, because Enron had plans to absolutely get rich if the Kyoto Treaty went into effect in this scheme of buying and selling pollution credits, something that the Environmental Defense Fund came up with and that many in industry saw very attractive. And Enron was very much for the Kyoto Treaty on global warming, not because they gave a damn about destruction of the climate, but because of their unique business in buying and selling energy futures and commodifying they thought they would just make tremendous amounts of money. So, you know, they worked with environmental groups to look like a responsible company promoting the Kyoto Treaty on global warming. And I think that, you know, each of us, as we read the coverage and see the coverage of Enron, should really try to look at this not as some sort of aberration, but as just one example of a typical excess that corporations have purchased the political system, and corporations get what they want from politicians. And what's really the difference between you know, what Enron was able to do in changing regulations and developing favors, except that they just went too far and they weren't sustainable, and they were lying about how much money they were making to pump up their stock prices.
Yeah, so, I've been reading about the hearings and stuff, and it's been interesting to listen who's asking the questions at these congressional hearings, and yet then to maybe think about how much money they received in campaign contributions from Enron.
You know, I think what it really comes down to is that those of us who see the excesses of corporate capitalism, who see what the commercialism is doing to schools and doing to the news media and doing to the environment, who see the need to really change fundamentally U.S. foreign policy to make it more just, we need to organize and build a powerful political movement. And that's what we've never really done over the last 30 years, where we've seen the rise of the environmental movement. And so there's this tremendous void now. There, as I mentioned earlier, there aren't many people who are identifiably standing up in the Democratic Party, for instance, or in the media, voices in the media, and saying, look, we have serious, deep problems. Our democracy's been hijacked. We need to organize, to mobilize, to build a movement to confront this corporate power and to control it and to take back power so that we can create economic systems that serve the people's interests and are sustainable. You know, that's the sort of discussion and debate that's been going on among activists at the grassroots, especially post-Seattle. But what we haven't really done is sort of rolled up our sleeves and gone about building in our communities a political movement that's linked up across the nation and can really make a difference. And that's a tremendous challenge. And it's going to have to be done, you know, in this degraded environment where the corporate media is going to want to focus on Enron as an aberration rather than as just an extreme example of a grotesque norm.
Yeah, it'd be hard to get the truth out, too. I just want to remind our listeners that you're listening to John Stauber on Roots and Culture here at Free Radio Santa Cruz 96.3 FM. He is the co-author, along with Sheldon Rampton, of Trust Us, We're Experts, How Industry Manipulates Science and Gambles with Your Future.
All right, you know, we've been talking quite a bit through these previous questions, and you've been eloquently talking about how oftentimes mainstream media and the prestige press do act as linchmen in this ongoing hegemonic capitalist interest, such as the corporate interest through Enron and so on. And you've talked also about how capitalism and democracy have been manipulated and sometimes confused by way of this third-party technique to achieve certain ends that inhibit and impede pursuits of greater participation and perhaps more of a cohesive movement on behalf of the environment, on behalf of human rights, environmental justice, and so on. And it seems to me that a lot of your work is trying to build that cohesion. And I wondered if you could tell us some more about your work. You mentioned at the top of the broadcast about your work as founder and director of the Center for Media and Democracy, and perhaps tell us a little bit about what kind of the projects, what kind of projects you're working on there.
Sure, I'd be happy to. One thing that we've been able to do this year, we started in 1993. One thing that we've been able to do this year that has been a very important step for us is now on our website at www.prwatch.org, PRWatch, like Public Relations Watch, .org, we have a feature that we call Spin of the Day, and we're able to report on propaganda campaigns as they happen. It's not in-depth reporting, but it's interesting reporting because, of course, we add links within the stories so that you can actually go and get a lot more information about whatever it is that we're reporting on. And it, you know, we've put out our PR Watch quarterly now for 8 years, and we've written 3 books, and we're available over the phone, and we speak a lot. But to actually be able to do reporting on these issues as they develop on the web has been a big plus. And the reason I started the center back in 93 is that it occurred to me through my activist work. I'd spent 5 years fighting Monsanto's genetically engineered food and discovering this tremendous collusion among the companies like Monsanto, American Cyanamid, Upjohn, Eli Lilly, the other genetic engineering firms, and the regulatory industry. And I obtained, through a Freedom of Information Act investigation, thousands of pages of internal PR documents that no one, you know, outside the conspiracy was supposed to see. And then I was actually spied upon by the world's largest PR firm, Burson Marsteller, working on behalf of Eli Lilly. Who, they started a phony group called the Maryland Citizens Consumer Council, claimed to be housewives concerned about genetically engineered food, and, you know, began attending meetings to gather information. And it just dawned on me that this is how every single issue is propagandized and lobbied. So I started the center so that there would be at least one organization in the world committed to investigative reporting on this constant manipulation that is now, you know, a pervasive part of our political and civil lives. So at the center, we basically try to do a better and better job of serving activists and serving academics and serving the media. There are still excellent investigative journalists in the mainstream press.
Yeah.
The problem is that they're very frustrated and that most people get their information through television, and that now half a dozen giant transnationals own and control the media, and the investigative reporting is becoming more and more of an aberration, and it's the propaganda that's the norm. So that's what we do at the center. But what's really clear to me is that you know, we don't organize seriously for political power the way the right wing does. And you can say, well, yeah, the right wing, that's Philip Morris, that's Monsanto, that's Shell Oil, They have billions of dollars. They own the political parties.
Yeah.
But if you look at the environmental movement in the United States, there's literally hundreds of millions of dollars raised from individuals and foundations every year. Most of that money spent by about 15 big mainstream environmental organizations. And while they're filled with really good people and they do very interesting research and there's a lot of commitment, those groups have been co-opted. They're absolutely no threat to industry. Industry has learned how to turn them aside. I think that we have a real tremendous responsibility and opportunity to build a movement that combines ecology, social justice, economic democracy, and the powerful human values that have been so steamrolled by commercialism in the hijacking of our democracy.
Yeah, I'm glad you bring up that point about some of the co-opting of some of the larger environmental groups. You know, it's something that the mainstream citizenry sort of just thinks, oh, you know, they're doing a good cause, they're fighting for what's just and right, and yet it's still being manipulated. Your book does an excellent job of sort of diving into how industry sort of plans ahead their strategy.
Yeah.
On, like you talked about, genetically modified organisms and your work with Monsanto. You also in the book talk about I think it's Mr. Sandman who briefs
yeah.
the mining industry on how to deal with certain attacks from environmentalists, from other groups. You also talk about how people surrounding chlorine and the use of chlorine prepare to deal with all sorts of you know, attacks from the environmentalists to people that work in their industry. Maybe if you could talk about some of the tools that the PR firms and the propagandists use to help out industry, that'd be really interesting.
Well, Peter Salmon is an interesting case in point. He's a liberal, first of all, and he makes just an obscene amount of money as a crisis management expert for industry, helping the mining industry, for instance, deal with crises where, you know, they have a tremendous incident at a mine in New Guinea. The environment is destroyed. The workers are exploited. It blows up in the press. And in comes Mr. Salmon to try to help the mining executives
yeah.
develop a public relations strategy. What's interesting about Peter Sandman is he also works for groups like the Environmental Defense Fund, who
yeah.
I mentioned earlier, one of the biggest environmental organizations in the United States, one that in the world, one that partners with corporations. He's been on a retainer for them.
Yeah.
And when you look at how corporations manage crises, it's a proactive management. They know that, you know, things are going to blow up in the press. They're going to be protesters. So they develop strategic. First of all, they have a tremendous amount of intelligence gathering. They're always spying on activists. There are firms like Mongovan, Disco, Duchin
yeah.
that develop ongoing dossiers on activists. And they use a divide and conquer strategy so that they can identify groups like the Environmental Defense Fund, like the National Wildlife Federation,
yeah.
like the Audubon Society, that corporations that are terrible polluters and have horrendous environmental records can partner with. This isn't in the book. It's up on our website in PR Watch. The National Wildlife Federation recently partnered with BP Amoco, because
oh,
BP
goodness.
Amoco is trying to posture
wow.
as if it's beyond petroleum and promoting solar and a green company. And so for a lousy $100,000 or so, they got to dress up all their gas stations with National Wildlife Federation artwork, and they sold through their gas stations stuffed animals made in China with the National Wildlife Federation logo that were supposed to somehow remind drivers that it's time to do something about global warming. I mean, this is really bizarre. Industry is so sophisticated that they know just how to co-opt, how to greenwash, how to undercut the environmental movement. And these big green groups walk right into it, take the money, and think that helping BP Amoco dress up its stations with stuffed animals that represent endangered species is somehow going to change the politics of this oil industry. Really, we have a very dysfunctional non-movement that raises and spends most of the money that individuals and foundations provide. And if we were able to create a grassroots-based environmental movement in the U.S. that were able to even get its hands on 10% of the hundreds of millions of dollars that individuals ship off to these big green mainstream groups and use that money for political base building, mobilizing, organizing, educating ourselves, working together to build positive alternatives, then we'd have the type of politically potent ecological justice movement that's really more typical of European countries than of the United States.
Wow, as you have sifted through a lot of these unholy strategic alliances, co-optation, greenwatching, etc., I must say I do admire your maintenance of hope for the future through these various endeavors.
Well, you know, I think that it's important to try to keep a perspective that no one knows what the future is going to bring. And what's really critical is that we work today individually and together at the community level and beyond to create the world that we need, that we want to see, that respects human rights. And, you know, I think it's sort of a dysfunctionality that we've all inherited growing up in a commercial culture that we sort of look down the road and we go, well, how the hell are we going to get out of this mess in the next year or the next 18 months, rather than looking at it differently and saying, you know, we have to start today to change our lives and our society, to take back control and to confront this illegitimate authority and just develop the strategies and tactics that are going to get the job done and be quite realistic about it. And frankly, I think it's really important that we have a good time doing it, and it should be a labor of love.
Yeah, you've really, through a lot of your work, have challenged us to exercise our critical thinking skills and to step back and think a lot about some of these structural issues. And explicitly in the conclusion of your book, Trust Us, We're Experts, you go through various good questions to ask of a study, and I was wondering if you could just please discuss some of those good questions.
Well, that's... That last chapter, I think, is excellent, and that's mostly the work of my co-author, Sheldon Rampton, who has this very Spock-like brain. But what we do in that last chapter is we lay out very specific ways that people can, first of all, recognize propaganda. It's all around us, but because the news is filled with it rather than analyzing it, we don't see it much. And it can be things as simple as identifying euphemisms. And now that the United States is engaged in a military action that's killing thousands of innocent civilians, we see that happening, the terms like collateral damage rather than killing civilians. We look at also how people like Peter Sandman work to carry out their propaganda campaigns. For instance, they advise industry that there are certain ways that people will be more likely to accept what industry does. If you can convince the public that a problem is just sort of chronic, rather than catastrophic, they're more likely to live with it and accept it. thousands of people are killed each year in highway accidents, we write, but rarely in large groups. Plane accidents are much rarer and cause fewer deaths, but because they can cause large fatalities, air travel is much more widely feared than car travel.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of advice is used by industry to try to take its crimes and misdeeds and package them in a way that's more palatable and less upsetting. But we tried very hard in our last chapter to take what we've learned in analyzing and discovering and identifying propaganda and just laying it all out.
Mm-hmm. So perhaps to put you on the spot, I may ask just to follow a few of those questions to you, such as why should we trust you, and who disagrees with you and why?
Well, you shouldn't, actually. Because my mom likes me. That's actually the question that I think every radio journalist should ask every guest. You know, where does your money come from? When we started the center, we set a policy we have of not accepting any corporate or government grants. People hear the term nonprofit corporation or nonprofit organization, and they think, well, you know, they're above the fray. They don't engage in commercialism. You know, they're mm-hmm. of the angels. But probably most nonprofit organizations have actually been started by corporations and their arms of corporations. And other nonprofit organizations that we think of as being very activist, groups like the Wilderness Society or, you know, the Audubon, take corporate money. And many big nonprofits, especially nonprofits working on disease issues, have become virtually arms of the drug industry. So just hearing that an organization is nonprofit really doesn't say that much. You have to find out where its money comes from. We do accept funding from foundations, and on our website, prwatch.org, we list our foundation funders. And we're going to actually be providing more information about our foundation funders. And then we especially rely on individuals who subscribe to PR Watch, who buy our books. And, you know, one thing that we've learned in writing about experts and writing about special interests is that everybody's funding comes from somewhere. And, you know, we've got an entire chapter in the book looking at university funding.
Yeah.
And how over the last 30 years, it's become Universities Incorporated. There was just an excellent article in the LA Times today, actually, looking at the problem of scientific information and research coming out of universities not being made available to the public or other scientific researchers because, of course, it's industry-funded, and what they're most concerned about, especially in the genetic engineering area, is getting those patents, getting those products to market, and making a killing for the university and the industry.
Great. Well, all of you out there have been listening to John Stauber with us here on Roots and Culture this evening on Free Radio Santa Cruz by telephone, discussing his recent book, Trust Us, We're Experts, How Industry Manipulates Science and Gambles with Your Future. He co-authored this book with Sheldon Rampton. So thank you very much, John, for coming on the air with us this evening.
Thanks, Max and Alan. I hope I see you Wednesday night.